listener production.
A warning. This episode contains references to suicide. If this content affects you, dial Lifeline on 13 11 14. G'day, I'm former police officer Brent Sanders. And for the past 25 years, I've dedicated myself to sharing what I've learnt on the force to the Australian public so they can better protect themselves from falling victim to crime. So with the help of some of the most respected current and former detectives and high-ranking law enforcement agents, we're going to pull back the curtain on what life is like on the force and what they've learned about how crime and criminals really work. These are real stories from real detectives. This week, the journey from general duties policing to specialist tactical response groups.
The guy was standing there. He had a scalpel to his neck. He made it quite clear that his wife wasn't going to be allowed to leave.
Matt Newlands spent 10 years in the South Australian Police Force. He'd go on to join a number of uniformed tactical groups and engage in some intense operations. But Matt's career came to a sudden and shocking end.
It was enough to keep me alive that afternoon, and I was operating really with a mindset of, let's just see what happens next.
We'll get an understanding of that situation, but to start, we're heading back to his time in general duties. It's 2010. Matt's been asked to undertake a welfare check after 000 operators heard gunshots whilst taking a call.
So it started out as a pretty standard day at the office, if you like, in general duties. And the guy that I was working with, in fact, I actually had gone to school with him. So we had a good background. And from memory, it might have even been his birthday. I remember there was a bit of banter and stuff at parade. And that was kind of broken up then when comms was looking for a patrol to start straight away. They had a check welfare job that was coming from Ambos, and that was pretty common. You know, someone dials 000, they have a chat to ambulance, and if Ambos think there's some concern for their safety, they'll let police know as well to come over and give them a hand. Ambos had suspected that it was something like a gunshot had gone off while they were talking to this guy, which naturally ramped things up a little bit for us. We grabbed our gear, we started heading out, told comms that, you know, we're on our way. I remember it was midweek because the house was actually across the road from a school. Interestingly, though, as we went to the job, I was the senior partner and I was chatting with my mate as we're heading out there. And as we pulled up out the front, given the nature of the job, we obviously had concerns given that it was a gun job. There was no indication that, I guess, there was anybody else involved. So we had suspected that it might have been a suicide. I remember as we approached the house, or as we're getting out of the car, in fact, that my mate said to me, "Do you think we should vest up?" I learned from this particular experience. I was still relatively junior. And I said to him something to the effect of, "Well, I don't think there's anyone else involved. And it sounds like he's shot himself," because there'd been no further contact. Foolish decision to start with, because you have to always think of your safety first, as much as we wanted to rush in there and potentially render as much assistance as we could. But as we were approaching the house, I knocked on the window. You couldn't actually see in. It was just this little unit. I knocked on the window and called out, and I heard a male voice that actually called back, which then naturally we've now got some serious concerns, because we suspect there's a gun involved. We didn't know that the person had necessarily shot themselves. We just knew that we had lost all communication with people at the house. There was nothing to suggest that there was anybody else there, but naturally our safety came first. So we backed away. I started just talking to this male voice through the closed screen door and couldn't actually see anything inside. So naturally the concern goes up and started requesting some other patrols to come and give us a hand. Given the time of day, we also had the extra concern of the school. We knew that children would start turning up sort of from about 8 o'clock. So had to start requesting traffic patrols as well and start having some of those broader considerations now as to what was actually happening. I remember at one point me and my partner, we were standing in the driveway. We'd taken sort of strategic placing so that we could still have at least clear observations of the front door. We'd both drawn our firearms at that time and were trying to just continue some type of communication to find out what was going on inside. And I remember this elderly gentleman who lived in one of the units where my mate was standing in his porch, making sure that we still had ways of getting out in case this guy did come outside. And I think one of the things that we often have to consider in those environments is if the person is in a position in a state of emotional distress and they are looking for ways in which to take their life, they've now got armed people outside that have the capability of doing that for them. So that's always a consideration as well. So we need to make sure that we're safe and that, I guess, the rest of the occupants there are safe too. This gentleman had opened up his door to come out and see what the commotion was. He'd heard a bit of yelling and carry on out the front. I remember my mate just sort of slammed his door shut again and said, you know, you have to stay inside for the time being. We ended up going through the motions of having a good conversation with this guy. He wasn't in a great way. And when the next patrol first turned up, the first thing that I asked for I remember throwing another friend my keys to my car and said, can you get our vests out of the car? Because I thought this is the last thing we need. And from memory, I had more concern for my mate and felt, I think, a great sense of guilt in that moment that he had actually asked, you know, should we do this? And I had sort of played it down. So lesson for me and others at the time was certainly to use all of those resources in relation to our safety right from the start. But mate of mine, he grabbed the vest out of the car. We vested up. I stayed there and my mate as well. We stayed in the driveway for some time talking to this guy. It turned out that one of the reasons why he was still struggling inside, he had in fact shot himself with a homemade 22 from memory. He had done it in a way that clearly hadn't killed him. However, it had rendered him blind. I remember seeing the x-ray later at the hospital. The bullet had lodged itself in the base of his neck there somewhere, and I'm sure doctors can talk to this stuff better than a former police officer, but he ended up coming out of the house. He did surrender, for lack of a better word, and he complied with all the instructions. We're able to detain him initially. Naturally, there was primary concern was really for his physical well-being, and then secondary after that was certainly his mental well-being. So we went through the motions there and obviously resolved that incident. We're able to secure the scene. He was the only person at the home at the time. Interestingly, once we had got him out, we had made him safe. We'd got the ambos in there to take him away from the home and get him back to hospital. We did do a search of the house and found that there was some cannabis growing at the home too, which then just adds another layer of scene guard, and we seized the firearm and we did all those things and then had to explore any criminal charges that would go with it. But I just remember it being quite an interesting job. When he did come out, he came out and he was covered like in a lot of blood, as I'm sure you could expect. And it just posed a very interesting scenario as he came out while we'd shut the street down outside and we're trying to safely resolve the incident. So an interesting one that sticks with me.
And Matt, amongst other things, you know, one of the reoccurring themes that we see so often, and can I say particularly with younger police officers, I mean, you'd been 4 years in the job at that stage. It's so common, isn't it, to have in behind some of these scenarios, these very sad incidences of issues with mental health. And I would say that he more than likely would have been taken by yourselves to a hospital for a mental health assessment. But this is a very common scenario for police to deal with, isn't it?
It really is. I think even as you're prompting then, it reminds me of another story where a gentleman did actually have his wife hostage, for lack of a better word. I don't know that it was necessarily as full on as that. She was never the intention for the harm that he was looking to cause. It was more so himself. Once we had resolved that one through just lots of talking, lots of communication, rendered that one safe and him safe. I remember sitting, as he was sitting on the curb waiting for the ambulance, had you not been there for the maybe hour and a half beforehand, before our conversation, you just wouldn't have thought that level of incident had occurred. He was just what came across as like an everyday bloke who was having some really, really difficult times and was navigating some significant challenges and wasn't quite sure what else to do, I think, in that moment. So you're absolutely right. Like the mental health, what people are thinking, I don't think anybody has just woken up one day and just decided today's the day that they're going to, you know, sort of end up in a standoff with the police. There's often some really quite complex layers of challenge that's going on in someone's life for them to get to that point.
I can't help but think that sometimes, Matt, and I get it, I understand it with junior police particularly, you know, that firerun comes out and there's suddenly that mental sort of attachment to we've got to bring this to a close now. There's an immediacy to it. Where oftentimes, as you've already highlighted, you need to take the time, you need to sort of find out what's going on behind, because so often there are these mental health issues. So often if you just scrape the surface a little, you can start to see a situation from a totally different perspective.
I learned a lot from that first job. I think that whilst everything was justified, the decisions that we made, you know, around the consideration for use of force, you're right. I remember the job that I touched on, the guy was standing there, he had a scalpel to his neck. And he was making it quite clear that police weren't coming inside the home. He made it quite clear that his wife wasn't going to be allowed to leave. I remember pulling up to that job. I got out the car. I did put my vest on at that time. But I remember saying to the guys as soon as I got there, just get out of his front yard. Let's come back to the footpath, you know, and let's just slow things down a little bit. What's going on? You know, just tell me, give me a bit of a brief as to what's happening. And we did just end up in conversations. The guys had done a really great job of building some rapport with him. But I think it's hard to come back down from. So when we start to escalate up and you know, look, police are highly trained. They're highly skilled in the use of, you know, the various uses of force that they do have. And I think most for police agencies around the country do the very best they can in training scenarios to sort of replicate those environments. I think there is something to be said about, you know, the first few times that you find yourself in those positions, where to the point that you just made before, you're absolutely right. Like you draw your firearm, you are now putting consideration of, you know, using lethal force against another human being. As justified as it is to protect someone else or to protect yourself, it's still, I think, a significant mental load just in that one particular component of that job. And then you have to consider all those other complexities as well that are going on around, you know, are my team safe? The other attending patrols that are coming, have I given them appropriate information to keep them safe? Have I given the ambulance the appropriate information to keep them safe? Are we putting all those measures in place to protect the civilians that are, say, living in those units, and then certainly the students and the parents that will be attending the school as well? There's a lot going on, and that's notwithstanding, you still want the best outcome for the person involved as well.
And I think it's that more experienced head too that comes into those scenarios. Like you said, arriving at that scene, guy in his front garden, you got the police straight off recognizing that we're on his turf here. We need to get off his turf. We need to get back to a neutral place so that he doesn't feel he needs to defend himself. It's all really interesting stuff, mate, isn't it?
It is. Actually, as you were talking then, I remember working with a UK police officer who had come over to South Australia, and naturally they bring a great sense of experience and wealth of knowledge, but also trained a certain way too. And for this particular guy, he hadn't carried a firearm back in the UK where he worked. I remember the two of us went to a job. It was early one morning. We went to a house for a check welfare. The lady that was at the place was known to have quite significant mental health challenges and ongoing challenges that did result in police attendance a number of times. We had real serious concerns for her welfare at the time. We managed to get into the home. It was really loud music that was being played. And the short version of it, remember there was a locked bathroom door. And when we, you know, banging on the door, we turned the music off and said, like, police, this lady presented armed with quite a large kitchen knife. My partner and I, we backed away naturally to try to create a bit of distance there. Given the threat that was there at the time, my response was to go to a firearm and not necessarily to bring it up to a position where it was necessarily going to be deployed, but it was certainly out of its holster. And noting his response was to draw his baton and extend the baton. So, and that was the way of dealing with the threat. I remember giving this lady quite a lot of instructions as we're trained to do around, you know, putting the knife down and trying to comply with us and do all those things that keeps all of us safe. And my partner took a bit of a step forward, thinking she just wasn't responding. It was like her, you know, just glazed over look, just staring at us blankly. So there's clearly a lot more going on than what we could see. And to your point around, we were just coming in at the end of what was quite a significant distressing time for her. I remember as he took a step forward, I was like, don't do that. I can't shoot if she tries to stab you. And I think it was a turning point. It was like, this standoff isn't working. You know, what are we actually going to do here? So I put my firearm away and gave her a stack of more instructions, which again, just was going nowhere. Thankfully, the OC spray was quite effective in that particular job just to get her safe. She threw the knife into the shower and she had cut herself a couple of times quite badly while we were there. And I think, you know, on reflection, she was likely just looking for one of us to make that final act for her, and which is sort of like, I think, one of those significant considerations each time when we're in those environments. You have to make decisions to keep ourselves safe, and we've got the tools to do that, but also trying to recognize, like, at what point is that person now maybe trying to use us as a means to an end. And so you've got all these things that are swimming around in your head, and you don't have, you know, these times aren't necessarily sitting around a table and having a nice, you know, conversation around, you know, these difficult things. They are highly intense, stressful situations where there's a lot going on, extremely wired, I think, and there's a lot going on physiologically, trying to make the most appropriate decisions and stay in, like, I guess, some level of control of yourself and trying to make sure that you're making really fast, well-informed decisions that consider all the outcomes.
So, Matt, if I could take you forward now to 2013, you're a member of the Uniform Tactical Team. It's a job that stemmed from a few months of hunting a guy that had broken into a whole string of houses, and just a case that unfolded from there. Can you walk us through that?
So my time at Uniform TAC, I actually had a couple of stints, and then I was fortunate to have the opportunity to go back in as the acting sergeant in 2013. I got a 12-month stint there looking after a team of five or six really proactive guys that were right into various parts of policing. They all brought their own strength and skill set, and it was a really proactive team. This particular job, we were also working quite closely with the CIB tactical team as well, plainclothes guys that were focusing on some more of the volume crime around house break-ins and stolen cars. And we'd had a string of homes over a few months that had sort of carried a similar MO, if you like. There was a solo guy had broken into homes. He was doing it midweek, midday, getting into homes, stealing mostly really easily accessible items, you know, PlayStations, laptops, cash, jewelry, that type of stuff. And was using, from memory, he was using a path that ran along a sort of the expressway down here. So it was kind of like a thoroughfare, if you like, that had a bike path and walking path. And because he was on foot, it meant that he was able to stick to the path, jump some fences, get into the houses, take what he needed, and then disappear quite quickly. And it made it really difficult, really challenging to set up cordons from a police point of view. And that's only in the event that the person was actually home or maybe a neighbor had seen anything. Because when you, I guess, start targeting homes through the day, generally speaking, people are at school and work and that type of stuff. So they don't really find the harm has been done until they get home. But this guy, we'd had a few sightings of him, you know, as it is often the case, especially in the police. There's lots of guys there that have maybe spent a number of years, and they start to get to know the local crooks. They get to know the local groups and gangs and that type of thing. And a few cops that I was fortunate to work with just seemed to have this exceptional ability to be able to look at a photograph or see a particular like way that someone was dressing or moved themselves, and they just seemed to know who it was. And on this case, we'd had a number of sightings of this guy. We were confident we had the right person. And from memory, it was a tip-off that we had that he was at an associate's house. There was nothing really that linked this person other than we knew that a friend of his was visiting this house. The occupants of the home were also known to police as well. And it kind of all the pieces of the puzzle seemed to make a lot of sense to the guys that had the background and knew this person's connections. We went to the house. A couple of the CIB guys in plain clothes, they got themselves into the backyard. Obviously, it's better to put uniforms at the front and the plain clothes guys in the back. And we knocked the door. The people were pretty anti-police. We had reason to go in. And you have to always have those considerations. And I think this is where legislation is really important. The authorities that police have are really important. It's really useful for uniform coppers to know all of those different authorities and the different ways that they can use legislation to get into homes or into cars. And so we ended up getting ourselves into the house. We started to search through the house, found this guy hiding under a blanket in a bed in a spare room. The house itself, once we had found him, it was almost somewhat a surprise that he was sort of so readily accessible. We thought that he would have probably gone to ground in there somewhere or got up into the roof or something. The rest of the house had then turned on us as well. So we ended up, from memory, we ended up with about half a dozen of the people at the house. We're all in handcuffs for various reasons, for either trying to fight police and try to get this guy an opportunity to get out and get on the run. I think they all well and truly knew who this guy was and the charges that he was up against. Really interesting job, that one. We managed to get him out. Frustratingly, as I'm sure those listeners that are police would know, that the system doesn't always necessarily work in your favor. I think we managed to end up getting him put inside for about 6 months, which was nowhere near really what was the justifiable time maybe inside. But naturally, it's really hard to put all of the homes that he had done to prove them. The evidence is really important. And, you know, sometimes he was good enough to get in and not necessarily leave a mark. It was absolutely his way of doing things, but we just didn't have enough, and prosecution didn't have enough to put him in on all of the houses. But we got him in for a few of them, and thankfully he did go inside for a while. I remember actually bumping into him. It was probably a couple of months after he had got out. I think guys like that, he was a relatively young guy, maybe late teens, early 20s. You generally keep an eye on them as to when they're inside and then when they're getting out. You know, that's just good policing, really, is to know that if someone who gets out and that's the life that he knows, there's a good chance that once he gets out and goes back into the same environment he left, maybe the need for him to continue those crimes will rise again. I remember bumping into him at the bus station and had that conversation with him just to say, look, you know, you're obviously now going to be we're going to be watching what you're doing and what you're up to. He had a bit of a change in, I guess, attitude, maybe. I guess at least in that interaction, he was apologetic. He argued that he had learnt from his the error of his ways. You take those things on face value. I think it's, you know, every cop will probably tell you that it's not too many times that you get those that have actually hit that turning point and their time inside is something that they have learnt from. But it does actually remind me of a job that a guy did do that. I remember speaking to him after I had gone down I put him inside for a number of offences. I went back down to the prison and charged him with some more offences. And as I was actually driving him back to the prison after taking him out and charging him at the station, which was just a process thing, yeah, he opened up and said he was grateful that he had been charged and sent to prison. He was off the drugs. He was starting to look after himself. He was able to focus on his nutrition. He was focusing on spending time in the gym. I guess there was, for what it was worth at the time, maybe he was just really good at pulling the wool over my eyes, but I think it's fair to say that I believed that it was having some level of impact on him. He'd been inside for a few months by that stage and presented very different to when we had first locked him up. So occasionally you get those good stories where, you know, the system does what it's, I guess, designed to do, rehabilitate. But yeah, coming back to this other guy, it was a pretty intense night. I remember I was one of the guys that was in the process of arresting this young guy in a bedroom, and I could just hear commotion outside in the hallways as, yeah, different members had found themselves now fighting with other people in the home. And after what felt like a long time, but it was probably only a minute or so, it all sort of came to a little bit of a quiet. I remember just calling out to all the guys, just a bit of a roll call almost, to make sure that everybody was okay and we got all the people that we needed. So it was an intense one. It was a fun one. And the reason why it was fun, I think, because there was a great sense of achievement. Like the team had worked well together. There was like the uniform tack and the CIB tack were working really closely together. The guys that we're working with were looking after each other. And we had, yeah, brought a resolution to a case, I guess, that had sort of been disrupting our region for a little while and was causing a lot of grief.
So, Matt, 2015, you've moved through to become a member of the State Tactical Response Group. So things are rolling along well for you with your career. Then 2016, things took a different direction and your career came to a little bit of a premature end. Can you fill in the gaps there for us?
I think it's probably important to come back to probably around 2013 during my time when I was at the uniform tactical team. I took a phone call. I was the acting sergeant of that team. I took a phone call from the patrol sergeant who told me that there was a job that was at a colleague's house and he was off duty, this colleague, and there was serious concerns for his welfare. So I sent one of my crew. I went as well. And when I got to this mate's house, unfortunately, Ambos weren't able to save him. He had taken his life. Ambos had attended. A mutual friend had gone to check on him and had, I guess, instigated the immediate intervention that was required at the time. And Ambos did the best they could, but it was unfortunately he was gone. I think for me, the reason why that's an important thing to consider is I often talk now about the issues around identity and the role that I played in that moment. And I think whilst I was a friend to all of the people that were in attendance, I was also a police officer and then a supervisor in that space as well. And that's not to say that the guys that attended didn't have it just as bad as I did. But there was I joined the police because of this desire to restore order at times of disorder and to be of service to my community. And here was this significant incident that was extremely awful and tragic. And there was nothing that any of us could do. It was what it was. And I remember I look back on now, a great sense of helplessness. I think a sense of guilt of not being able to do anything. And I hadn't necessarily reconciled any of that and I didn't lean into any of that. The way in which I dealt with the significance of the impact that it had was to double down on what I knew, and that was to go back into the policing environment. So I just kept going back into work. When I had my uniform on, life seemed to make a bit more sense. I knew it was real clear as to what my role was, what my rank was, what my position was. It was outside of work where things were starting to certainly slip. A lot of my personal warning signs that I pick up on now, my sleep had been significantly disrupted. I was operating on about 2 to 3 hours of broken sleep a night. I was drinking quite heavily. I was relying on alcohol to get to sleep, and that's not necessarily conducive to a good night's sleep either. And then I was relying on caffeine to keep myself awake through the day. I was suppressing a lot of the emotional response that was coming up. I was sort of pushing it aside and down. And I think we get really quite good at that in first responder roles, is because emotions can often prevent us from doing our job. So finding a way of bundling them up and pushing them down is really quite useful. Not so useful when that's all you do. And so over the space of that 2013 through to the beginning of 2015, I was starting to become really quite unwell. I was viewing the world, I think, in a very different way. And policing, I guess, they're almost like a revolving door of the people that we often work with in the community. And the reason why I find that that's important to touch on is this sense of meaning and purpose that being a police officer or being a first responder brings is really quite powerful and quite significant. To lose that sense of meaning and purpose is also just as significant and impactful. So for me, I think by that time, I think because of the regard that I held my friend in and still continue to do, albeit he's not with us now, he was such a good bloke, like a good human being, a good copper. I figured that that was likely the outcome for most. He wasn't the only exposure to suicide that I had had. And I think I had, by that stage, I started to lose meaning in what it was that I was doing. So by the beginning of 2015, I'd become really quite unwell. It did coincide with me being fortunate to be selected for a position at the State Tactical Response Group, which I spoke about, your uniform tactical team. State TAC was that, but virtually without any boundaries. So it's not Star Group. It's public order management and resource. It was highly sought after at the time. I was very fortunate to get a position there. And so my environment changed. And so the people that are around me didn't necessarily know me as well as maybe they had when I was at Christie's. I'd been there for a few years. So I was able, it's like a perfect storm of being able to hide a lot of the emotional stuff that was going on for me. I had been to a doctor at the beginning of 2015. I was diagnosed with severe to extreme post-traumatic stress and depression. I had started to disconnect and withdraw from friends and family. I was, even when I was home, I wasn't really present. I remember even thinking then that I wasn't really needed at home. It started to cause significant issues with relationship with my wife. And by May 19 of 2015, I left home after quite a big altercation, big verbal argument with my wife, and all my own doing. And I had considered taking my life. I ended up on the phone to my mum. I was heading into work, and my mum was leaving interstate. I remember having a conversation with her, really, which was just a goodbye on reflection. She said something to me, though, when we were talking, where she was saying, I know what you're planning on doing, and I'm not in a position to get back there to stop you. And it was, please promise me that you'll go to your mate's house when we get off the phone. And I had sort of a throwaway comment of sure. I did end up going to a friend's place because I had this moment of clarity of didn't want the last thing, my last conversation to my mum, be a lie to her. So I went to a mate's place, and obviously I'm still here. But it's not to diminish the size of the challenges that I was having through the rest of 2015. I still continued to go to work. I didn't tell work that I was seeing a psychologist, or not really seeing a psychologist. I had engaged the process but didn't believe in my diagnosis. I figured everyone else around me was just doing it better, and maybe it was just me. And if I just kept sticking it out, that things would get good again. Until a lot of the, I guess, the poor decision-making started to creep into work as well. There was one particular job in July of 2015. I was working with a couple of guys from State TAC. We got sent to a job with a lady with a baseball bat at a bus stop. It was late one night. We rocked up. We told the other patrols who were coming to not bother. There was concerns initially that it might have been something a bit more significant. There was a group of shops nearby, and thought maybe that someone might hold the place up. But it wasn't that. It was a bit benign. There was nothing really to it. We took the baseball bat off the lady. Whilst it wasn't necessarily a crime, we knew and we came to an agreement with her that it was not wise for her to be catching a bus that late at night into the areas that she was in, and the areas that she was heading to was also not wise. She was known to us. And so we brought the bat back to the police station. Process should be to book that in as an item of property, and then it gets stored in a secure facility until such time that we're ready to return the bat to the owner. You reverse the process. You go through the administration process and go and collect it during business hours, and you take it on your inquiry. That all felt like it was all too hard for me, to be honest. I think that's really the only thing I can really rationalize with now, and it just kind of floated around in the office. A few days later, I made a foolish decision to keep the bat. It's a difficult decision to reconcile because it just doesn't really make a great deal of sense. I had a full-time job, and I was definitely in a position to be able to buy my own bat, but decided that I would keep this baseball bat. One of the guys on the team had concerns about some of the conversation that I was sort of, I guess, joking around of you know, it's now the team bat. And he went to anti-corruption branch with his concerns about the conversations that I was sort of instigating. And then on the 7th of August 2015, it was a day shift. I came into work. I usually got there a little bit early. I came in and made some breakfast, and when I sat in the team office, we're all just kind of chatting, and the boss at State Tech, he actually popped his head in and said, "Oh, Matt, can I have a chat with you?" The guys at State Tech knew that things weren't great. They knew that I was having some difficulties in my personal life, that I was working through some stuff with my wife, and they were accommodating of that. They were sort of constantly checking in on me and that sort of thing. So I had kind of figured that maybe the boss had just heard that maybe there was some stuff going on. I went into the boss's office. He sat me down and I remember asking something to the effect of, "How's things going?" And I said, "Oh, not great, boss, but I'll be okay." His phone rang and he said, "I have to take this." He stepped out. Didn't think much of it. He was gone for a couple of minutes. And then when he returned, there was two detectives with a video camera that came in and identified themselves and said that I was under arrest for aggravated theft. They placed the video camera down on the desk in front of me and, read me the different caution and rights and that type of stuff. And then it was have a few phone calls, contacted the police association, contacted my lawyer. It was obvious that everybody knew that this was, I say everybody, the people, the different agencies involved were aware that this action was going to be taken. That morning I was wearing the police uniform. I actually asked if I could take my police shirt off and wanted to get changed. And now when I talk about that, it was like because I didn't believe that I deserved to wear it. I had a great sense of shame already just around, I guess, how I was traveling with my mental health and not being good enough to stay in the cops. And if people knew, I wouldn't be allowed to do this role anyway. And so I think when I realized that this was now happening, it wasn't just tarnishing my own reputation. I was now bringing, my mates who wore the uniform and did the uniform a service. I was bringing that into question. That was the last time I actually wore a police uniform. It's the 7th of August. I've took a shirt off and, I haven't worn a police uniform since that day. So I was fingerprinted. I was photographed. I was released on bail. They asked if I wanted to apply for bail. I knew that if I said no, that I would be detained and probably be detained for quite some time. One of the things that I remember during that time, though, which was one of the hardest things, was having my suspension papers and an administration order preventing me from speaking to any of my cop mates. It was a really, really challenging time where I was just now found myself isolated and completely stripped of my identity. I didn't know what that would mean other than like the easiest way to stop the pain and the harm would just be to take my life. The boss drove me home, and on the drive home, it was about 40 minutes, he didn't ask me anything to do with the job. He asked me about my wife and my daughter, my parents and my brothers, and now, like, doing the stuff that I do now and the work that I do now in mental health, whether he was doing it intentionally or not, it worked. It was really trying to tap back into all of those other roles that I had. He was getting me to find a sense of meaning and purpose elsewhere outside of the police and that identity. And yeah, it was enough to keep me alive that afternoon. And I was operating really with a mindset of let's just see what happens next. I think by May of 2016, the courts had deemed that I wasn't going to go to prison. SAPOL had tried for a custodial sentence or requested that at sentencing. They brought up a different previous jobs or historical jobs of people selling information to bikies and that sort of stuff and likened it to the similar sort of stuff and asked for a custodial sentence. Thankfully, the magistrate didn't agree, but he did believe that a conviction was in order. He said something to the effect of, "To convict is to condemn." So that was his way of making sure that I was going to be punished significantly. SAPOL had already sacked me a week before sentencing. They called me to headquarters and sat me down and said, despite an exemplary 10-year career, they couldn't look past this act. And so they dismissed me. The following week I found myself convicted and sitting on the couch as a convicted ex-police officer thinking, "What? How did this happen? How did I get here?" So from wanting to be a cop since I was 4 years old, I was now 31. Policing had occupied 27 years as either a dream or a reality. And I had to come to terms with the fact that this identity was completely stripped and I had no idea who I was or what my future would look like. But I had started to put in a lot of work around just trying to get myself well. And I talk about borrowing belief. I was borrowing belief from my wife and my mum and my dad and my brothers and my mates that this wasn't going to define me and my future. It was a point in time. And yeah, I just had to stay alive and keep doing the things that I knew served me well and hope that one day it would all be worth it. And yeah, fast forward a few years and here we are.
Jeez, Matt, that's a hell of a story to unpack, mate. I mean, that is, that's a harrowing story. Look, this to me, I mean, you know, anti-corruption detectives, internal affairs, the police is your employer pushing for a custodial sentence from a guy with 10 years service without a blemish who just didn't hand in a baseball bat that should have been handed in. It's just bizarre. You must be at a loss even after all this time. What are we, 2016, what's that, 8 years ago? You must still be at a loss as to try and explain that whole process, I'm sure.
I remember saying to my wife when I left police headquarters before sentencing and I'd been sacked and I was still trying to come to terms with that and I was still really unwell. I'd only really just spent the last couple of months or few months starting to get well again. I remember saying to my wife then, like, there has to be a reason for this. Like, this makes no sense. And I think some people have said as well, like, do you think that there is an alternative option for them to keep you employed? And I don't really know if that's possible. I think the snowball had already started to cause the avalanche by that stage, and it was hard for them to come back from that. I think that if that was their intention to, you know, set an example, it probably did that. There was a lot of guys that I was talking to after all of this that they were just so scared whenever they had made slight errors and in good intentioned like process that maybe they'd exercise some discretion, and then yeah, there was just this constant fear of what's going to happen to me now. I remember saying to my wife, as I mentioned, that it's got to be a reason, and I'll be back. I've always been intentional around. I don't want people not to join the job. I don't want people to think of leaving the job because of my story. I don't want people to think that at all. I think the job is a really good one. I had a great time. I met some fantastic people doing that work, and now I'm really proud of the 10 years that I did get to wear the uniform. But yeah, it took a long time to try to get my head around that. And then it's not like I woke up one day and this happened. I can't tell you when it did, but it's just an acceptance of it is what it is. There's nothing I can do to change the outcome. I can't go back and change the way like that I behaved. I can't undo, taking the bat. I can't undo the harm I caused to my family. Like during that time, I can't undo the challenges and the public perception of the uniform. Like it's not lost on me that when this stuff goes public, it's not just like SAPOL members that get brought into challenge with the community. It's like that stuff goes national, where the public now might have less confidence in police. And you know, from my foolish decision, I made interactions with the public more difficult for my friends and colleagues. All of that stuff weighed really heavy. But there had to be an acceptance of like, I did that. It is what it is. Nothing can change that. So what am I going to do about it? How is it that I'm going to just not be that guy that just forever sits on his couch and is the guy that stole the bat? And I was like, I've got to learn from this. Like, how did I get to there? And are my friends and former colleagues at risk of going to similar places with them, the way they're thinking and the way they're behaving? And that for me was really around trying to come back to the picking up on that thread around meaning and purpose. I had lost it. I'd lost my identity. It took me about 3 years to come to terms with what had happened. And it was, I think in 2019, someone said for the 100th time, if given the chance, would you go back? And this is the strange thing, Brent, is that from the time that I was kicked out until this time, it was about mid-2019, whenever someone said to me, if you were given the chance to go back, would you? It was 100% yes. there was no thought like, yes, please, like, give me, like, let me go back. And I knew how harmful it was. I knew how, like, dangerous it was for my health. I was very conscious of the fact that had I gone back, it probably would have got to a point where maybe I did take my life. And all of the things that I learned following, I guess, that experience and getting kicked out and having to find my identity, I wouldn't necessarily know all the stuff that I know now. Whilst I might not have a criminal conviction, I might still be sitting in an office somewhere wearing a police uniform because I'm not well enough to be operational. Don't know. I might not also be doing the work now with first responders around the country and private organisations and doing the mental health education and counselling and doing the work that I do now. So, yeah, you have to look at it in the whole sense.
Matt, just want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us down there in South Australia. And thank you for those 10 years of service to the good people of South Australia and also the work that you continue to do now, Matt. And as you said, you know, goodness, there's the old saying, is there one door closed, another one opens. But that there's a lot of bumps in the road, a lot of roller coaster rides for you in between that policing door closing and the other one opening. But just thanks so much for coming in and thanks for your honesty and having a chat to us.
Thanks so much, Brent.
Crime Insiders Detectives is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Brent Sanders, produced by Ed Gooden, and sound designed and imaged by Link Kelly.